that the spacecraft pushes into the comet with. It pushed itself back up off the comet. Since the harpoon's in a grab, the ice screws didn't get a chance to screw into the comet. And off it went for another flight. And this thing took off for two solid hours, almost 2 hours. Went a couple miles up and then came back down again. And the same thing happened, and the next time it went up, it took about 7 minutes before it came to its final resting place. And it looked like it was laying on the side when they got all the telemetry and pictures back. And they could tell by looking at the one picture looked at a wall, another looked at a crater, and another one's looking at the sky. So that's how they figured that out. And they didn't have cameras that would rotate. They had a series of cameras just located all around the perimeter of the spacecraft. And the pictures I saw were, of course, black and white. And it has a 60-hour battery charge. That's what this thing has in case it landed in the dark. And sure enough, it's in the...
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, timed out. Sure enough, it's in the dark. Its original landing place was toward the end of the smaller part of this dumbbell-looking comet. And now it wound up, going toward the middle. And if you look at the pictures there, it's pretty dark, and it's probably under a cliff. They never really pinned down exactly where it's located. And right now the relay is completely drained of its powers. It looked like it was only going to get 1.5 hours of light per day, and that's not going to be enough. You need a lot more than that. It's got solar panels all over the body of this thing. And they were hoping for, a nice spot where most of the time it was daylight. And that didn't happen. So that thing, it's kind of like asleep. They think that there's an outside chance in the future, as the months go by, as the comet gets closer to the sun, naturally you're going to get more light. And it could possibly wake up and communicate again with the Rosetta. Some of the people are guessing no, and some are guessing yes. But they got as much data, analytical data, and chemical analysis, of whatever they can get before the batteries quit. So, it was a successful landing. In fact, they landed three times. And they did get quite a bit of telemetry and...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Maybe what part of the comet is made out of it. And but meanwhile, Rosetta is going to be doing the same thing from space. That's got 10 instruments on board, so that'll continue for the next year. We went over the perihelion last week, and that was roughly 1.1 AU. So it doesn't get closer than Earth orbit. It goes out to past Jupiter, and the perihelion is around Earth's orbit, but slightly beyond that. It's not one of these comets that are going to burn in close to Mercury, even closer. It makes this revolution around the sun. It's got a 6.5-year period, and we'll see what happens. Definitely Rosetta will stay with it and analyze everything, and they're very happy with both spacecraft. I had a guess. I haven't read this anywhere, but this is my own guess of why these harpoons didn't attach. Originally, apparently this Rosetta was supposed to go to another comet, and due to different flights that were happening at the time in French Guiana, the thing launches from South America, European spaceport. And at that time, 10 years ago, things were a little bit busy there, and they wound up launching later than they had planned. So they couldn't make it to the first comet they had thought about. And you got to remember, this whole project was thought about, and they started working on it 25 years ago. It was conceived. There's a lot of people that are around 25 years later getting to enjoy the fruits of their labor. Now, I think what happened, I'm going to be surprised if this comes out, they did readjust the strength of the harpoons and on board the lander, because this particular comet was going to have a lot less mass, so they cut back on everything. Maybe they cut back a little too much, where these things never got released, or something of that nature. Whether they were, I think they were probably pyrotechnic device. I remember reading that. But whatever they used, they tweaked it down a little bit. Maybe it went too far. John brought out a good point last week that maybe they have a thruster in the opposite direction, and this way when the lander hits the ground, it'll, the thruster will help stabilize it and keep it there. Well, they did have that. So John was right about that. Unfortunately, that didn't go off either. The telemetry came back that two things did not work: the harpoons and the thruster. So much for that. And that's pretty much it on that. Do you want to comment on that before I go on? Because they have another similar type of mission coming up. Not us, but Japan. I can talk about that in a minute. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
When Rosetta first released Philae, the lander, I think you said it was a spring release. It wasn't actually a firing of thrusters. And then it moved at something like 1 meter per second. It spent a number of hours going down to the comet 67P. And when it got real close, it was supposed to fire the harpoons and then reel in on the cable and the harpoon as a way of winching itself down to the surface and then dig in the earth screw anchors that are on the three legs. Okay. The harpoons either didn't fire or didn't work. The thruster that was supposed to press it against the asteroid, that thruster didn't work. And so it bounced off the surface, bounced up in the air for about an hour and came back down and hit again. However, you and I know that Murphy's Law dictates, Murphy's Law dictates that when it came down to the comet, it wasn't perfectly aligned. In other words, the three legs were not exactly flat against a flat surface on that asteroid. Guarantee one leg hit first. As such, when that made contact and it bounced back up in the air for an hour, guarantee that the Philae was given a little bit of spin in that process. Whether any thrusters or inertial wheels or anything else, gyroscopes on board Philae, that would force it to keep its proper orientation so that when it comes down, it doesn't come down upside down. During that bounce, I know some talk was given to Philae during that incident at bounce that had to be trying to twist it, trying to give it a rotation in some direction. What's supposed to counter that rotation so the next time it comes down to the planet, it's coming down feet first and not upside down? WS2N, K2LIW, Red Bull.
They had a flywheel, and that was working perfectly. So that kept it stable from moving. So that was okay. In fact, they were going to use that. That kept everything, when it came down, it know, they knew it was going to come down square. But they were going to use it at the end of the time when the batteries were going to run out. And what happened was they were going to do a couple of things. They had the ability to turn, in fact, I think they did, to turn the body of the spacecraft in relationship to the three legs. They can rotate it. And by doing that 30 degrees, they figured out they would be able to get more sunlight. They could accomplish that. Whether or not they fired off the flywheel again, I don't know. They thought it had enough power when you first turn it on to make it hop again. That's what they were hoping for, that this thing would move and maybe move it to a better location. Whether that occurred or not, I haven't read that yet. But that was the plan, last-ditch effort to try to save this thing. So I'll have to wait and see. This clock on board, what will happen. If you get enough sun, it will communicate with Rosetta again, and they'll be happy about that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They think that that's it, but they got their fingers crossed. You never know. Back to you, Dan.
Is 67T rotating at all, Paul? If it is, you have to do some very careful timing when you release the lander, knowing how long it's going to take the lander to get from Rosetta down to the surface of 67B, and what will the orientation of 67B be at the instant of impact. So, is 67B rotating at all in any plane, or is it completely steady and always facing its same side toward the sun? What do you think, Paul? Go ahead.
It's rotating. And, I think that was around 12 hours or so, too. I don't remember the rotational period. I know they set it up with Rosetta every, it was a 12-hour period, so it rotates twice per day. That's what it was. Rosetta's going around it. And I think that was roughly 10 or 12 hours on the rotation for the spacecraft as well. So, it's going at a walking pace at very, very slow speed, they said. They only got, maybe 4 or 5 hours of communication with the lander per day, the way the orbit was in relation to the spin of the comet. So, it is spinning. Not only, you got to see the way where it really landed. If you were to take a barbell and start going toward the center where you grab that barbell, it's kind of like getting in there, and it stays dark most of the time there.
Yeah, there's two different ways I could rotate a barbell. I could rotate it so that the shaft that you and I hold on to becomes the axis of rotation. Or I could rotate it so that the ends of the barbell go end over end, if you know what I mean. So depending on how that rotation occurs, you would like to believe during part of the rotation that Philly is going to see some sunlight. Also, with 20/20 hindsight, it could have been planned in such a way that if it does fall into a place where it doesn't see sunlight for a long period of time, that it wouldn't drain the batteries all the way down to ground. It would go into a so-called safe mode, just to, go down to minimum power drain and run the clock, but to wait until the solar cells come back and so it can come back to life. It looks like that part of the contingency planning maybe didn't take place. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, well, I didn't hear that. I mean, I did hear they'd run their 60 hours down if that need be, but what would happen would be much science as possible. They had no, apparently no plans of, you know, shutting it down at 10 or 20 amps, what, you know, amp hours, whatever it had left. They were just hoping that they'd get somewhere in this launches thing. Paul may know that, you know, maybe shaped like a potato or something, but this was a very irregular object. So they didn't know that to start with. But I'm sure they would have come up with a couple of other ideas on what to do. You know, put a couple of thrusters on there if the thing sits in a dark spot for too long, you know, automatically, autonomously, thrusters go off and push it to somewhere else, anywhere better than where it was. Now, in another week, on the 29th, Japan is launching Hayabusa 2. Hayabusa 2 is going out not to a comet like this one, but it's going out to a asteroid. It should get there in about 4 years. And after that, it plans on coming back to Earth. It's a sample return mission. So Hayabusa will not orbit the asteroid, but kind of like just sit there and then do its investigation over time. You know, in one place, just follow it along. And then at one point, they'll let it go all the way down to the surface. It's really supposed to be a touch and go, but it'll probably stay there a little bit. And then they release a charge, and a slight detonation. And then spacecraft's going to come back and pick up some grams of dust. They're not going to bring back that much, maybe, you know, a couple of grams or, like I read, maybe a half a pound of stuff. They're lucky. And it'll go into a container and...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Boy, that was quick. It'll probably come back and land in Australia a couple of years after that. Now, these missions take a long time. Rosetta was over 10 years, still going for, you know, going to go for another year. This one here is taking off now, probably six or 7 years from now. It'll return to Earth. So this thing is called Hayabusa 2. That's because back in 2003, a little over 10 years ago, they launched another one called Hayabusa 1. And that did the same thing as this. Went out to an asteroid and brought back very little, a couple of grams of material from the surface of an asteroid. That was supposed to have a rover type of thing, but instead of a rover on wheels, very similar to what we just talked about with the flywheel, this lander it was going to release failed. In fact, Hayabusa 1 was actually facing in the wrong direction when it released, and this thing kept going and wound up out of space and never hit the asteroid. But the plan on this thing was to hit the surface and stay there. And then every once in a while they would start up a flywheel, and that would be enough to go to another location. So actually the European Space Agency knew that system would work because that was an actual plan by Japan to do the exact same thing. Well, on this mission too, they're going to have the same thing. Once it gets to the comet, they're going to do the same thing, except they're going to make some corrections on whatever failed last time. Make sure this thing gets down to the surface. So that's, time marches on. I'm sure there'll be other comet missions. This is an asteroid mission. The United States, we have an asteroid mission that's planned in the 2020s. And more to come if you're hanging there long enough, Dick. I just want to mention, I know we talked about it a lot, but Orion is coming up this December 4th. to the New Horizon mission. But coming up in less than a month now, December 4th, you have a launch from Florida on Delta IV Heavy. And that's quite an impressive rocket. It looks like three rockets that are bolted together. That's the way it looks, with another one sitting on top. And that's going to be launched in the Orion spacecraft along with the service module and the escape system attached to the top of the spacecraft. It's a big setup. If you see pictures of it, it looks like it's about over 80 feet tall. You know, the whole payload. So we'll watch this thing go out for a 4.5-hour mission. Go out to 3,600 miles. Go around the Earth two times, bring it back, and test the heat shield. That's the main thing. And then they're going to test the other pieces of equipment as well, like the escape rockets built by Orbital Science. They're going to look at how that does, how the navigation does, how the thrusters work, all the for navigation. Should be interesting. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
I do have another question about Philae. The gyroscope that's on board, inertial wheel, gyroscope, spinning mass, whatever we're going to call it, kind of curious as to where was the axis of rotation. Was it straight up and down, so to speak, so that it tries to keep it will allow the spacecraft to rotate in azimuth, but keeps it steady as far as the 3 feet coming down straight to the surface. That's question number one, axis of that inertial wheel gyroscope. And wouldn't you let that run continuously? Why bother turning it off at any time, so to speak, other than the battery's running down and it no longer can be powered? Does Philae have any kind of thrusters? Is there any way it can hop off the surface, and if it hadn't run out of batteries, is there anything it can do to hop off the surface and come back down for a better landing, so to speak? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
From what I understand, there were no thrusters, just the one on top to try to hold it to the surface when it landed. And you shut it off after it lands, or it's going to keep the flywheel running. And they said flywheel. I don't know. Maybe there was, maybe there was two. You know, I would think that, you know, it'd be a good idea to have two, so you don't want to wind up with precession or something. But maybe it was one. I don't know. They said flywheel, singular. That's the deal on that. They tried at the end. That's what I was saying before. They were going to try to move one of the legs and see if they could move it a little bit where it would push itself from where it is. They had that capability, and they had the flywheel capability. But there was a problem between the scientists and the engineers, I'm sure. The scientists wanted as much information back with the power that they have left in the batteries, and the engineers wanted to move this thing. The scientists didn't want to take a chance of having it move and wind up, go from the frying pan into the fire. So, I guess they won. Back to you, Dick.
So we had a total of 60 hours of battery power. In theory, on the way down, which took some number of hours, wasn't eating into the 60 hours because you had solar power on the solar panels on the way down. Has it already used up 60 hours on the surface? That quick, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, Friday at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time was the last time they heard from it. So that was it.
Yeah, there was a dropout. What day, what hour was the last time they heard from it?
around 7 o'clock, a little after 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, was the last time that they heard from Philae.
Okay, Eastern Standard Time Friday, it landed around 10 o'clock in the morning, and 5 afternoon is the last time you heard from it. That's nowhere near 60 hours. And in theory, the solar panels were charging the batteries on the way down. So it doesn't look like they got full battery life, Paul. Go ahead.
50 hours out of it. They planned on 60, and I know they got 50 hours, so whatever that was. I guess it was down there 2 days, battery power. You're counting the 7 hours, too. you're crossing that off the list, saying that, well, the battery power is enough to do what it's got to do. I don't know that, you know. To do the science, this thing wasn't going to be operating 24 hours a day. It would have been charging the batteries, you know, hopefully for, you know, 12, 15 hours a day, and then take whatever charge you got, and maybe could have done science, you know, maybe 2-3 hours a day. Probably one of those deals there.
I wonder if the telemetry told them that after the so-called final landing, after the couple of bounces, were they getting any power out of the solar panels at all, or was it in a complete shadow? And sure, it would be nice to find out that the electronics has a so-called safe mode, waiting for the sun to come back, so to speak. But I'm not hearing the sound of a safe mode. Are you, Paul? K2LIW?
No matter what, they're going to get 1.5 hours of sun per day, that they know. And they said that's nowhere near enough to do the science that they need. So, I don't know. Maybe there's heaters on board to keep things in good shape. I don't know what kind of daily drain this thing would normally take. But, I mean, they had big plans. You know, they were going to drill. In fact, I think they did drill into the surface. And they were going to put the dust into the oven. They had an oven similar to what you would have on Curiosity. And we're going to find out what this thing was made of. Whether or not that was successful or not, I don't know. Too soon. I haven't read any reports yet if that worked out. But that was the plan. Just, you know, do everything and don't worry about moving the spacecraft. You can imagine putting the stuff in an oven and bringing it up to 900 degrees. That was the plan. That would kill a battery real quick.
I think there's an earth screw anchor at each one of the 3 feet of the landing pads. Is there reason to believe that any of those dug in, Paul? Is it really attached, or is it just sitting on the surface at some crazy angle? On top of that, 1.5 hours of sunlight per day, if you can go into a low enough power consumption mode, that eventually builds up some battery power. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
That's what I thought, but I didn't read that they were counting on that to, you know, wait, 2-3 weeks, you might have enough power to do some kind of science. They are hoping that, you know, somewhere down the road, this thing has enough power to at least communicate with the Rosetta. They are hoping for that. And as far as the ice screws, I know they activated them. Whether or not they grabbed anything, I don't know. It might have just kept on spinning and maybe nothing happened. But they're called ice screws. They look like probably about 8 inches long. And, they look like about 3/4 of an inch in diameter, with maybe an inch on a thread, you know, in diameter. So that's kind of what it looked like. If you were up in the Antarctic, you would use ice screws. Back to you, Dick.
Too bad there isn't a rescue mission that can be sent. The Rosetta is in orbit around the comet. The comet is rotating at a certain rate. is it possible that the same face of the comet always faces toward Rosetta? Is the rate of rotation and the rate of orbiting at all related, Paul? KQLIW?
It's definitely orbiting. That's why it keeps losing contact with Rosetta. So that's what happened there. I did send you a link to a video that they did, like a demonstration of the difficulty of what they plan on doing with this comet. And it was done by European Space Agency astronaut aboard the International Space Station. And he had a spear, and a heavy floating spears that they experiment with on the space station. And he attached piece of Velcro to it, and he had a little simulation of what the relay would look like, and a piece of Velcro on it, and he had it floating in space, and he would release this thing by hand, and it was, you know, a slight push toward the spear, and it took him a lot of tries, but eventually it stuck to the Velcro, and then said, okay, now this is the way it really is. It's spinning, so he started rotating the sphere, doing the same thing. Of course, that was harder. And then he said that finally after succeeding, he said, now it's also translating. So, you know, in other words, it's not perfect. The orbit is, you know, is not, you know, not a, what would you call it, a balanced type of orbit. You know, it's going like on an angle. They call it translating. So he said, look at this. A little demonstration of what they're talking about. No thrusters, no nothing. No, we should just release this thing. And it went at 2 miles an hour all the way down to the comet. I mean, they were really, I think, rolling the dice with the system. Back to you, sir.
Rosetta is in orbit around the comet at how many miles, and why so far away? Paul.
14 miles, so I guess that's, you know, maybe a safe distance. I don't know. But that's the distance it was and is, you know, from the center of gravity of this thing. You know, it's a very odd-looking shape if you've seen it. And I forgot the rotational time on that. I think that's in the, I don't know, I don't remember, but it's not a triangular orbit like we were talking about. I mean, they ran those triangular moves to get this thing into orbit, but it's a circular orbit around the comet.
Question and one YDY.
Go right ahead, Mike.
Hank, my name is Hank. The question is, I didn't think the comet had enough gravity or enough mass to have enough gravity to have a true orbit. Is thing actually, or is Rosetta actually in a elliptical orbit, or is it in a parallel flight path?
It's supposed to be in orbit. I mean, I've seen a couple of European Space Agency, you know, simulations of what it looks like, about how it got into orbit with this triangular setup. It's unbelievable. It took 16 different moves by Rosetta to get into the circular orbit. Back to you, Hank.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. I just kind of really didn't understand that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I don't know if they must have really, I mean, the engineering that goes into putting something in an orbit. I mean, they've done it before with Eros and a couple of other things, but, you know, putting things into our orbit with something that's not a sphere, it's quite a feat.
I think you said you don't know, but maybe you've got a guess as to what's the orbital period. The orbit of Rosetta around the comet makes one swing 12 hours. What's your guess?
I think so. I think that's, I think, said the comet was 12 hours, so I don't know. I'll have to check the details on that. I mean, if it was both the same, there would be, you know, it would be almost like a geosynchronous orbit by our satellites. It would be looking at one spot all the time, and it's not. That's why it was unable to keep continuous communications with Bailey.
I think we know the dimensions of the comet. We can make a guess as to what the density of the comet material is. Therefore, we can make a rough guess as to the total mass of the comet. If we're in orbit 13 miles away, if that's the number, and you put that all together, that's a calculatable orbit. We could calculate the orbital period from that, Paul. So, how close do we know the guess at density and the mass of the comet? Go ahead.
I've read the math, but I don't remember it. They said, you know, they have a pretty good calculation of what it is. To give you an idea of the size of the thing, it's about 2 miles long. And, in other words, if you superimposed, if you took this comet and put it down on the ground and put it on top of Manhattan, it would go from the east side to the west side. Wouldn't make it from the north to the south, but you would make it from the East River to the Hudson River.
Yeah, that gives us a good feeling for the size. They know the mass. They've obviously done that calculation when they calculated what will happen when it's in orbit at, I think you said the orbit is 13 miles of distance between Rosetta and the comet. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, they said 14, but, you know, close enough.
Okay. That's enough numbers to make a rough guess. Good stuff. Okay. Your most favorite thing you're looking forward to, is that New Horizons?
Well, yeah, for next year, that's pretty exciting. But the next main favorite thing I know you're looking forward to is the James Webb Space Telescope. Here you got Hubble this year, 25 years old, and we're at minus 4 years for James Webb Space Telescope. But yeah, New Horizons next July when it goes past Pluto, that's going to be great. I mean, you know, people have been talking about Pluto forever, but you get a real picture of what the landscape looks like. It's a real looking planet. You know, if you go past Jupiter and Saturn, you know, Uranus, Neptune, they're big gas planets. This thing, you know, this thing has real land it's going to be looking at back there.
James Webb, I guess it's 2018 launch. Was there a time when they thought it was going to launch in 2016, or did I just remember it wrong?
I never heard that date. I always heard 2018 from way back when they've been talking about this thing. This thing was originally called the New Generation Telescope. But they finally gave it a name. So, yeah, I never heard any other date except that time. $8 billion project. So, big money.
Yeah, that's a new one. I hadn't heard that big number. Wow. Anybody got any other questions for Paul before we go over to Wes? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, there being none, give us a little bit of a rundown of that last email that you mailed Wes. And it's very similar sounding, if I pronounce it too fast. Multipactor and multipath are very different. People make some pretty funny mistakes with similar sounding language, like somebody will make a joke saying, I represent that incineration. It's meant to sound like, I resent that insinuation. I represent that incineration. Over to you, Paul. I mean, Wes, and to XJN, KQRIW.
Second, Doug, I just wanted to give the the contact for me is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Go ahead, Dick.
That's how you write to Paul to make suggestions, give questions, and so on. You've got it, Wes. K2RIW. I know that Wes has been experiencing a crazy reflection from a big flat building that's a block away from his house. And that building, the big flat side of the building, seems to be acting like a mirror. When you look at Google Earth and you look at that building versus Wes's house and 2XJN, it's like a billboard, almost like a drive-in movie screen. It gives you a nearly perfect reflection between it and this particular repeater. The net result is that, although it's a very rare circumstance, let me drop. Although it's a very rare circumstance, it looks like the amount of signal that Wes gets from the reflection off the building, where that building is south of him, versus the direct signal he gets from the repeater, where the repeater is east of him, those two signals are almost identical in amplitude and almost 180 degrees out of phase. When you get that kind of very sharp null, almost equal in amplitude, two separate paths, blocks apart, so to speak, but 180 degrees out of phase, you can get some very weird sounding effects. If somebody set up a vibration in that building, that means that minor motions of the building would make the reflection of the building go in phase and out of phase as far as the two signals that are going to Wes's antenna. So from time to time, he hears weird signals, weird sounds, because of that nearly perfect cancellation. One possible solution for Wes, let me drop it. One possible solution would be use a Yagi-like antenna and aim at one or the other. Aim at the building or aim directly at the repeater. And that will drastically change the ratio of the signals that he's getting from these two separate paths. But right now he has a kind of a co-channel interference. And there are times when his signal into the repeater is not experiencing as much anti-phase, and therefore the signal is very strong. And there are times when he's radiating the right number of watts, but the signal getting to the repeater is very weak, because the two signals are almost out of phase, a direct path and an indirect path. So that's for the two signals to be the same in amplitude, for the building to be directly oriented, so you get a specular reflection off the building, angle of incidence off the flat side of the building equals angle of reflection. Unusual. Doesn't happen very often. It looks like it happened to Wes, so he's eventually going to have to make some kind of a change to his antenna to improve one of those signals over the other. That's sort of the way I see it. You probably had more conversations than Wes than I have on this exact subject, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, I have, Dick, quite a few times. It's just very strange. It's only this time of the year, so who knows what's happening. Maybe they have something on the roof, water tower, that they change position of vanes or something. And it's only actually affecting his reception. He gets out okay. It's garbled coming in. So there's a couple of strange things going on there.
Yeah, that's almost a reciprocity failure. How do you get a clean signal on transmission and a not clean signal on reception? I wonder if he owns a spectrum analyzer by which he can look at his antenna to the spectrum analyzer, sweep some reasonable frequency region around 146.25 or 146.85 and find out, are there other strong signals in the area that are giving his radio grief? Also, does Wes have more than one radio? Does more than one radio behave the exact same way? I wonder if that experiment's ever been done. Back to you, John.
Well, I know 2 years ago when he was having the problem, he claimed it was solved by cutting a branch on a tree. And he hadn't had the problem in a while, but this year it's back again. He used to have two radios. Now he only has one that's working. So that he can't do. But I'm sure his analyzer would cover that frequency, 1 to 200 megs. he might have an interfering signal that has, you know, no PL tone, so it's not being heard on the repeater, but it may be swamping him.
Wes did have two radios at one time. Does that mean one of them might need repair, Ripple? John?
Yes, Dick. He burnt up a relay in one, and then the second one burnt up a relay. He repaired one of them, but he just let the other one go. That's the one that was in the automobile, his mobile one. But he hasn't done anything about that.
Is that the transmit-receive relay in the final stage of the transmitter? And is it a 50-watt transmitter that burned up a 50-watt relay, so to speak? Or is it one of the crystal can, plastic box type relays that's doing other switching functions in the radio, if you happen to know? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's similar to an ice cube, but it's a small one. And that's right. And both of them burned up in each radio. And he runs 100 watts. And, you know, he's always running max power, which I don't do. So I have not experienced that difficulty that he has, but his radios are older.
What brand and model number is that radio, John?
The 2000 Kenwood.
Have other people, to your knowledge, has Hal told us that that's a common failure of that radio? Or is it just a particular block of serial numbers that have this failure? Do we happen to know that?
Well, Hal really has no value for these radios. He thinks they're pigs, and they have a lot of problems, and very serious ones, he said. And, you know, if you have a problem with them, these have to go back to the manufacturer. So Hal has no good word for the Kenwood 2000, for sure. And I don't know if he's noticed that particular problem, but he said there's been a lot of other problems with them.
Now, there's a Kenwood 2000. I think there's a 2000X. There's probably 2000X1. Some of them have plug-in modules that go up to 432, 1296. If you happen to know that series of model numbers versus capability versus failures, and maybe the later ones are better, give me a couple of words on that if you happen to know, John, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, I have two Kenwood 2000, the GS2000Xs. The only difference is they're all the same, except the X has the 1.2 gig. Now, the third Kenwood 2000 that I have is just the standard, doesn't have the 1.2 gig.
Did I remember correctly that you were interested in the 2000X that was part of the estate of Bruce? Go ahead.
Yes, I had made an offer to you. You were going to check and see, check around. But I don't know if you got a chance to do that.
Not yet, but you're on the list. And if you did purchase that one, I guess you're saying that would be your third one of the series that you own?
No, that'll be four. I have three now.
You're down to your last three. Okay. And so you run yours a lot lower than the 100 watts maximum. Therefore, that relay never burned up. And you would think that they would have designed it with differential keying. In other words, the relay flows first, then the RF power happens. Whenever somebody designs a transmitter so that you fire the relay and you fire the transmitter at the same time, the transmitter comes on in a microsecond. The relay takes 20 milliseconds. It's an electromechanical device to move. And therefore, you've got full blast transmitter power across those contacts as they're slowly coming together and arcing. And that's not a good thing. So I'd be curious if anyone's ever studied the schematic to find out if it does have differential keying. The guys who set up transverters on the microwave frequencies, they know that differential keying is very important. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
KC2WGB. Dick, I'm not sure of that, but I know the relay itself is a real flimsy thing. They could have done a lot better. I would have, if I have the problem, I'll just replace it with a heavier relay.
Yeah, I have in the past, on occasion, gotten away with very flimsy relays that were not even designed for RF service. As long as the relay is switching dry, as they say, or cold, in other words, you flip the relay, you let the contacts come together and settle down, Then you hit it with moderate power. You can get away with murder if you do that. This was TechNet number 1530 of the series that began in September of 1982. Paul, John, Hal, and I intend to be back next week. Try to be kind to each other and enjoy this crazy... And try to enjoy this crazy hobby of ham radio. Over to you, John, for any other comments. KC2WGB, T2RW Clear, but listening. Bye-bye, John.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
They pulled back
some of the undamaged cable from before the manhole, and then they pulled in that new piece, the 15 blocks or 20 blocks, whatever it was. So that was just like a butt splice. Every single one got spliced through as if it was continuous run of cable. So you ended up having to do a lot of splicing, and someone else did a lot of pulling, but it got done. How long was it, how long a job was it to get all those cables back up and running? Had our cable pulled, we were in position and on standby. They had our cable pulled by about 11 o'clock in the morning, and it took from 11 o'clock in the morning till about 3:30 the next morning for us to splice. We were splicing in 864. You forget, I have no idea what an 864 is. I'm assuming it's 64, it's 8 strands of 64 stranded cable, but I might be wrong. You would be. It's 864 fibers. Okay. As I said, I'm not in the industry. I don't know what it means. Let's see. We went out for a nice dinner on Saturday night over into Farmingdale. What kind of food? To the Black Forest Brewhouse. They had German food. I had the Jäger Schnitzel and the chocolate Doppelbach. No bratwurst? No bratwurst, no blood sausage. Okay. Saturday night, myself and one of the other faculty members had received gift certificates to the same restaurant, and as a result, the four of us went into Manhattan to go out to dinner together. Let's put it this way. The restaurant is overpriced. The menu, very interesting, and the portions, very small. Like just the kind of place that you would want to go. And to Bibi and Mobile. Skeevy got back from the rat's mouth, so he should be on in a little while. Well, since I had no appointments with any of my students this morning and no meetings, I decided to take my time getting ready and not rush. So I just transferring over from the Meadowbrook onto the four-laner. And then all of a sudden, it seems to have gotten heavier rain.
Yeah, I'm just between Markey Post Avenue and the Meadowbrook myself, and the rain has kicked up quite a bit.
Oh, so you got a little bit of a late start also.
Yes and no, I guess, late start. I wasn't in any big rush to go run out into the rain.
Yeah, well, fortunately I don't have to be out in it too long, just the amount of time it takes me to walk from the garage I parked the car to the school, which is only about 2 blocks.
See where my parking puts me today.
Yeah, it's nice to have a reserved spot. You just pull into the garage and say, bye, see you this time.
Well, it's good to be king, I guess.
No, if I were king, I wouldn't be paying for that spot.
I guess. But now when one of your stalker-type students decides to want to confront you, they know where you park your car.